Hi, and welcome to Designed for Life, the podcast that brings design and technology teachers and business leaders from across the UK together as we collectively seek to inspire, energize, and create the workforce of the future.
Hi, and welcome to Designed for Life, the podcast brought to you by the Design and Technology Association. My name is Tony Ryan. I am the chief executive of the association and also the proud producer of this podcast. We came up with the idea of this podcast really to bring interesting concepts to the classroom, to bring things to teachers, to connect the worlds of business, industry, and what was going on out there in the world with the world of education. And what more is happening out there at the moment than the effects of COVID as we start to slowly find our way from COVID towards a world where it's still going to be around, but it hopefully won't dictate the way it has done over the course of the last 15, 18 months. And things are changing, and we know that people are not going to want to run back to where they were before. The idea of that five-day week is being challenged now. The idea that people will travel to a city centre and will all attend an office is being challenged. The idea of this sort of hybrid work where you do 2-3 days at home and you do some time at work and you get the collaboration that you need with colleagues, but you still work at home. But also the way that retail is changing and the way that consumerism is changing, I feel all of these things are really up for grabs at the moment. If I go into my local town centre, we've had shop after shop after shop closed down. The biggest one of which being Debenhams, which is on 4 floors on the shopping centre and recently closed, leaving the shopping centre really like a ghost town. So you have to ask the question, what will the future look like for town centres? How will we shape that? And who will shape that? Well, today we have a guest whose job is exactly that. Ming Cheng is an architect, an urbanist, and also a tutor at UCL. And in case you wonder what an urbanist is, I mean, I suppose town planner just about touches on it, but it's much, much wider than that. It's looking at how we use public spaces. It's looking how we might utilize spaces in order to get the best out of it for people. And obviously, with what's happening in city centers and town centers at the moment, I would imagine that Ming's going to be an incredibly busy person over the course of the next months and years. So I think I'm going to hand over to the podcast now and just let the talking do itself. So over to the Designed for Life in conversation with Ming Cheng, architect, urbanist, and lecturer. Welcome to Designed for Life. And today we're here with Ming Cheng. Ming is, I mean, there's a whole string of things that I could talk about. Architect, urbanist, UCL tutor, the Bartlett School of Planning, design council expert, director at Place Profile and Urban Architecture as well. We're going to touch on all of those, I think, over the course of the next hour and a bit. But what we'll do now is hand over to Ming and let you introduce yourself, if I could.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. You know, it's a pleasure to be here. That's quite a big introduction. I'll see what I can do, you know, to try to tell a bit about myself. Well, what can I say? Born in Hong Kong, and so have a very close association with Britain, you know, under colonial rule. And then came here, you know, kind of like any typical, I suppose, civil servant parents working for the government and being sent over here to study at school and then went to university. And then subsequently started studying planning at UCL, and that's the kind of long association with that. And then later on retrained myself to be an architect. And then subsequently, you know, actually worked for quite a few companies and also luckily just being asked to actually teach, you know, back there. So it's been an immense joy, you know, to actually teach university, you know. So that's the brief intro, you know, of me.
The potted history there, it's just fantastic. We'll dig into some of those bits as we go through the podcast. We do this with all our guests, is we take you right the way back to school. Was school in the UK or in Hong Kong?
It's a bit of both. Yeah,
a bit of both. So what was the school experience like for you? Just really interested with all the guests to find out how that sort of shaped where they are now.
I obviously born and raised in Hong Kong, you know, so went to school in Hong Kong until I was about 14, 15. There's a very, very different kind of school system, you know, in Hong Kong. Is very typical kind of Asian way of teaching is just cram as much information, you know, as you can into your brain, and is all about learning. It's all about remembering, you know, facts rather than just being kind of like critical thinking. But I suppose I'm slightly different. I'm quite sporty. So also actually do quite a lot of sports, you know, as well when I was younger. And then actually get sent here to study my GCSE and A-level, which is a very different experience. Because obviously when you came over here, you suddenly actually just being almost kind of open up to a slightly different ways of teaching. It's a bit freer with a little bit more probing questions about, well, what do you think? So that's been quite helpful. But also being helpful, you know, as well, is actually have to grow up quite quickly because obviously your home is 5,000 miles away and you have to be quite independent.
Were you boarding, Ming?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you were.
So I suppose you could say, well, I didn't know it then, but I do actually know it now. You know, I was quite privileged, you know, to go to an independent, what you call private school, you know, it's a boarding school. I suppose I'm kind of like the one of the many very different kind of kids being sent to boarding school, because all my peer, they probably would have been a lot more well off, you know, so to speak, than I am. But whereas, you know, as I said earlier, parents is civil servant, you know, that's part of the perks, you know, being in the colonial government. So it's quite a different thing. But I suppose learning to be independent, I think that's actually quite an important thing, you know, to me, because is subsequently when I go to university, you know, that is actually quite a big transition, you know, for most people. Whereas most people, kids now, you know, when they first actually leave school and go to university is the first taste of freedom. Whereas I had that since I was 15. So when people actually start drinking, you know, I'll just go, what the fuss is all about? I could do that since I was about 15, 16.
Doing that for years. I'm an expert.
Exactly.
Can I explore that a little bit? Because it's easy to sweep over that. But that's a big cultural change, a very critical stage in your upbringing as well. And it's a big educational change as well. And then you've got to adjust to all of that at the age of 14, 15, where most 14, 15-year-old lads, the hormones are kicking around left, right and centre, and you're just developing and finding out who you are. That must have been a tricky moment. I mean, was it always going to be the case? Did you have time to prepare for it, or was that sort of sprung on you?
It's sort of yes and no, because I have an older brother who went to the same school. So I kind of knew that that was on the card, because my brother actually went over there. But it is still a big shock when it finally happened, so to speak. It doesn't help that even though my brother, my older brother, he was actually in the same school, by the time when I arrived, you know, he has left and went to university. So I don't have anybody else to kind of keep an eye on me or whatever. So people say, oh, yeah, I know your brother. But at the same time, you're on your own and you have to find your own feet, you know, all that. So that has been kind of the beginning or the making of me, so to speak, because of the independence. And I think that is quite an important journey, you know, for me at that point.
I would imagine a very much a sink or swim situation. You either find your feet and actually get yourself organised, or you drown with the whole thing a little bit, I would imagine.
Yes, it is indeed. And you learn quite early to say, well, life is not fair, so deal with it and just get on with it.
Get on with it, yeah. Well, you have got on with it. Let's move on then with your story there. So you've gone through, you've done your A-levels, university from there. I mean, at what stage did you start thinking, and it was planning and architecture were both in the head at the same time, were they?
Yes, it's a little bit of both. I mean, my story is slightly different. As any typical kind of sibling, my older brother, he's an architect, so he's studying architecture. I mean, I didn't realize, you know, at the time that I actually want to do that. But it's actually during half term, he was studying in Newcastle, I remembered. And it's during half term, so, you know, I just went up to go and visit him because that's, you know, you've got nowhere else to stay, you know, during half term. And I went up to Newcastle and then he just showed me around. And he's like, oh, yeah, this is actually what I'm doing. And he actually showed me the studio, you know, that's where I'll be mostly actually doing most of the work, you know, at university. Back in the days when you don't have computers, you know, you have big studios and every student will have a big A0 drawing board. And you see this kind of massive big rooms with lots and lots of drawing boards and lots of students there actually just start drawing. And with all these amazing drawings actually being pinned up and all that, I was just blown away. And so I just asked him, so what do you do? And I say, oh, yeah, you know, actually design buildings and actually going looking around with all the different kind of environment. So that was actually quite revealing. But I suppose, you know, what really interest me was one Sunday, we just went out to the city of London and we just walk around, you know, there. And even now, especially now, but even during normal times, the city of London is actually dead at the weekends. I remember just walking around the city of London, they're just almost kind of like blown away, you know, by all these kind of different architecture with new buildings sitting right next to old buildings and all that together. And you get to say, oh, yeah, if you're being an architect, you know, that's what you would do. So I was quite set dead on to, but I mean, well, there's two things, you know, I was actually very interested in architecture at that point, but I'm also fascinated by cities, you know, and by places. You almost go to the city of London and say, well, how can you make a place like that? That is just amazing. You know, how can you actually do stuff like that? But my journey, you know, to architecture is slightly different because probably I didn't actually work hard enough. I didn't actually get the grades at my A-levels. And I have a choice, you know, what the hell am I going to do? You know, either you repeat it for a year, you know, go and study at a polytechnic to study architecture at that time, or you actually study something else. And I suppose, you know, that at that time, I just sort of think, well, my parents actually spending all that money for me to actually go to study a very expensive education system. I'm not so sure I have the heart to actually tell them I'm just going to study in the polytechnic. That's kind of like the stigma, you know, at the time, and being Asian, you know, at the time. So I thought I actually want to go to a university, and I was actually interested in actually cities, you know, as well. So I went to UCL and studied town planning because it's actually in a much bigger scale. It's all about policies, you know, about city makings, you know, slightly different journey. And it's actually quite different, you know, as well, because I became a slightly different architect, so to speak. But and then the journey is I study planning and then I also study a master's in urban design because that's what I'm interested in. I later on actually just think when I actually start working, I just discover that my knowledge is actually not enough, you know, for the things that I want to do because I want to study as well as the big scale. I actually want to know the nitty-gritty of how you put buildings together. So I just decide later on to retrain myself as an architect when I actually have a family. So that's kind of my journey back into architecture. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
That sounds like a pretty unusual route for an architect to take. I mean, there can't be that many people that have come through that sort of urban design, town planning route into architecture. Does that put you in a fairly unique position?
Yes, it is. Because normally there's quite a lot of architect planners. The other way around is they study architecture first and then they've been working in much more like the town planning field. And you can get your planning qualification much quicker because it's a slightly different route. But whereas if you actually have planning and urban design, if you study that first, if you want to study architecture, you have to start from scratch. So you still have to go through the whole process, which is the total of 5 years, you know, altogether. So, I mean, I even taken a slightly longer route because I was working at the time. So I was actually studying part-time. So in terms of studying, it took me 6 years, you know, of studying to get through the first and second degree. So it's quite a long process. Wouldn't recommend it if you want to have a life.
It's the hard way to get there. I mean, I've said a couple of times on this podcast, I left school at 16 with very little. And the qualifications that I got, I had to get the same way. It was part-time, it was evenings, it was all sorts. It worked for me because I wanted it. I wanted it more than other people around me because having left at 16 with nothing, there was this vacuum there that I needed to fill and I was quite hungry for it. And I think that helps. But would I recommend it? Not if you want a life as well, really. It was a bit tricky at times.
Indeed.
So what was missing? Just very quickly, you know, you said you'd gone into the urban design and planning, but there were parts of your knowledge base that were missing. I'm just interested what they were exactly that architecture gave you.
Yeah, just the confidence and the knowledge of how you articulate yourself and then how you actually draw, when you actually draw, let's say, a master plan. I mean, the joke, you know, amongst ourselves is you can almost actually see a master plan not drawn by architects because they don't understand how buildings actually being put together. So it depends on what you want to do. I mean, quite often master plan, you can almost say, well, it's just a diagram. It doesn't really matter. But for me, myself, you know, it's actually being taught quite early is when you draw a line in a drawing, it means something. And you've got to understand what it means. And I think that is the part that I feel there's almost kind of like a burning thing to me is I'm drawing something in there. I know it kind of works, but I don't really understand how it works in detail. And that really bugs me.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And someone at some stage is going to have to make that. So therefore, it is important.
Yes.
So I'm going to flit around a little bit here, maybe. As an outsider to the process of urban planning, it appears to me to be as much about reading habits and behaviours of people as it is about the actual buildings, etc. I mean, how much of that was the draw for you, was actually trying to work out exactly how people think? There's a bucket load of sociology on this, isn't there?
Urban planning is a massive field. You can have various fields that you can actually specialise in, all the way from really, really big, let's say, regional policies, how you're going to write something, some sort of big set of policy that will affect millions or thousands, all the way down to, let's say, local policies, or even down to where you're going to have new settlements, how you're going to regenerate high street or town centres, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a kind of different scale. There's a very, very big field. And you are absolutely right that quite a big part of it is part of sociology as well. And we had a little bit of that when we actually studying planning. But I suppose, you know, what I'm interested in is, because of my architectural background, I'm actually quite interested in what I call making places, interested in cities, is what is the makeup of that. And part of it is about people. And because what it is, you know, there's no point having all these fancy buildings or streets that you design or public spaces behind if nobody actually go and visit it. So studying human being, it is actually a big part of the job. But at the same time, that's why I think when I actually in the profession, that you work as a team. So you will actually have other people who will be much more specialized than I am in terms of, let's say, landscape design, or even now I'm actually interested talking even to anthropologists, you know, because they will actually know more about how humans behave, you know, than let's say an architect or an urban planner. So this whole process of what I call placemaking is complex. And it's not just about one or two people. It's not just about, oh, the architects will know what to do, or the planners will actually know what to do, or traffic engineers. It's a group effort, actually putting it all together with a common understanding of how these things actually work. But go back to your question, you know, yes, definitely. It's about the study of people.
And people change, and therefore the places that they live in, they work in, that they commute through, they need to change in order to reflect the way that society is moving, I guess. So it's a never-ending feast, isn't it? You sort of get one bit right and then it starts all over again.
It is. It is. Well, funny you actually mentioned that. And I think that is one of the current issues. That's what we are having. Architects or urban designers, we've been commissioned to produce what we call a master plan. You know, so we have the drawings about what this place is going to look like in 20 years, you know, or whatever, when we actually created that. But that, in a way, that is just a diagram. And that is actually what we aspire to, what this place is going to look like. We're hoping that's what's going to look like. But as you say, making places is iterative. It's a circular process. It's not about, right, we've drawn this plan, and then once we've done that, that's it. We are done. It's not quite like that, isn't it? You almost got to go, well, that is kind of the version one of what we're thinking is going to look like. And people change, places change, there'll be different events, or there could be different economic or social or political issues that we'll have to deal with in time, and we'll need to adapt to that. But that's what we actually need to deal with in terms of what we're doing right now.
This podcast is brought to you by the Design and Technology Association, working increasingly with design and technology teachers across the world.
With Place Profile, I went onto the website and had a look, and it seems that the mantra right away through the website was that exists to help clients to create successful places where people want to work using a combination of science, data, and design. Now, that struck me because design's a very creative thing. It's a very mobile flow, if you like, whereas data is the exact opposite of that in many ways. How do those two blend together? Because they seem like yin and yang there. They don't seem like two things that work together. Where do you start, basically?
Funny that you mentioned that. Yes, making places, or when you get into architecture or design, is a very creative process. And yet, I mean, I've been taught, you know, brought up like that. And I actually did many master plans, you know, using that, and still do. But I think this is actually my interest in looking at cities and making places. And that almost kind of go back to when I was actually working for a company called DEGW, probably more than 10 years ago, and actually working with, you know, the colleagues there, is what is actually what we do is when we actually look at buildings, we actually measure buildings in terms of how we're going to procure it, how big, how tall, how many doors, you know, how big is going to be, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we don't seem to actually measure places when we actually design any of this. But whereas, you know, when we design a building, we say, right, how big is it going to be? You know, how big does rooms need to be? How many chairs do we need? How many rooms do we need? And how many lifts do we need to do? Because it will give us some sort of performance that you will need as a kind of like an indicator. But yet when we actually design places, we don't do any of that. It's all about creativity. That's what we do, you know, at the moment. And the second thing that why is actually this conversation actually start is also if you look at, let's say, in the medical industry for medicine, you know, the study of the body, you know, even back into 16th or 17th century, you know, when we don't know anything about our body, scientists or doctors, they actually say, well, I don't know, actually quite know how the heart actually work, you know, or how the vein actually work, you know, or how the pumping actually, the circulation system actually work. And they actually go and study how the systems actually work. And they discover, you know, all this discovery about, oh, right, oh, that's how the hearts actually work. They pump the blood, you know, through the system and they behave a certain way. And we do certain things, you know, certain things will happen. And yet for, let's say, cities and places that we created, we've been doing that for, what, hundreds and hundreds of years. And nobody seems to be measuring anything about how the places actually perform. And every time we actually go and design something, we'll just say, we're just going to use our artistic brain. And then we just think that we produce these beautiful places in there. If we can convince ourselves that it looks beautiful, people will come and it will be successful. And lots of people and trade will carry it out and everyone will be happy. And yet, as we can see in the past, what, 50 years, you know, or so, all the things that we did, we have this kind of ideas about how new places should look like. And it just becomes a hit and miss because we just engage in our creative brains and not actually start almost thinking about, well, does it actually really work? You know, why is it not working in this way? So it's actually a conversation that myself and my colleagues, you know, through quite a long conversation about that. And we just say, why don't we actually start measuring? I remember, you know, first time I actually came into this country, kind of a 15, 16 year old, you know, of myself. And the first time I actually go to central London and go to Covent Garden. As you probably know, you know, Covent Garden is what we call a very successful place that people will go and enjoy themselves. You know, it's very successful. You know, lots of people go around, lots of nice restaurants, you know, all the places that you want to go to. And yet, when we try to say, why is Covent Garden successful? Even now, you know, we use very, very qualitative words to describe it. It has mixed use, you know, it has a sense of place. It has lots of public space. Whereas I start to turn around to say, okay, public space, you know, it has public space. So how much public space? Is it a lot more? Is it a lot less? Oh, it's a lot of mixed use. So okay, well, how much mixed use are we talking about? Are we talking about 10,000 square feet or 20,000 square feet or 50,000 square feet? What we're trying to say is in place profile is we're not saying that we don't engage with our creativity. We should engage our creativity. But at least we got to be able to actually ask the right question. So when you actually say, right, okay, let's create another Covent Garden in Manchester or whatever, you know, or anywhere around the world, we can actually carefully and being very precise to describe what it is. So Covent Garden will have a series of public spaces and altogether assimilate to 10,000 square feet, you know, just say, you know, as a figure. And then has mixtures of retail will be this much, and then restaurant will be this much, et cetera. So you have a series of data as a starting point. And then when we actually created the master plan and then create our creativity, at least we are comparing apples to apples, not apples to orange. So that's where place profile actually starts. And that's the conversation that we would like to have.
It makes a lot of sense. And when you're talking about Covent Garden, I'm just thinking in my head now, there's a flow to Covent Garden. I can't remember too many times where I've actually been held up by crowds or whatever. There's a flow to movement in there, which feels quite nice, feels quite free. And there is a sense of place with it as well, that you know you're somewhere special in London. It's a destination point, isn't it? So as a result of that, it's cool. But I can see there's a data to that that could enable you to replicate that somewhere else. on a smaller scale or whatever you might want to do. So it does make sense. It absolutely makes sense. And data just encourages you to ask the right questions, yeah?
Indeed. That's all it is. I mean, almost kind of like the mantra that we have is, if master plan is the answer, what is the question?
Okay, that makes sense. I'm going to ask you a tricky one now. I mean, COVID, the last 18 months seem to have accelerated so many things, which were happening anyway. And I think our habits of shopping, our habits of living locally were changing anyway. But I think the last 18 months has really accentuated that change and pushed it. I'm looking at the town centre here now. I mean, I live in Woking in Surrey, which is like going through massive change at the moment in all sorts of ways. But the town centre's dead. We've lost Debenhams. We've lost about 8 restaurants along the main strip. And when you walk through there now, it feels like a ghost town compared to how it was before COVID. Is the town centre dead? Are we going to have to completely reimagine how we use these places, how we use these massive spaces? And also, the sense of community is not what it used to be. I mean, the sense of community used to be built around places of worship. It used to be built around libraries, around public buildings, if you like. But they don't really exist anymore either in the same way. So where are we going with this, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting question. And it's almost kind of like a constant debate within the, let's say, the architecture community as well. You know, what is the future of, as you say, town centre? Or more likely, some of the debates that we're having is, what the hell is going to happen to the City of London? Because people found out, or big corporation actually found out, we don't need all these office spaces. We need some. We don't need all these office spaces to actually cram loads and loads of people to come in every day to get work done. So that is a big shift. And then that is an ongoing debate and almost kind of speculation.
And that's not just the office space, that's the restaurants, the coffee shops, the bars. I mean, it's the whole urban community, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. The implication, I mean, is not just London, right? You know, it will be like Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, you know, all these places, city centre, who always have all these office spaces. And then you suddenly think, what the hell are we going to do? You know, because people realise that, I'm not saying that we will be completely working from home, you know, from now on. I don't think we'll go back to that. But I would imagine that some sort of hybrid kind of working life will probably, most people will probably embrace. People probably don't want to work 5 days a week from home, but then at the same time, because they want to see their colleagues or they actually want to go out, you know, whatever. But if you ask most people and you say, do you really actually want to go back to the old ways, actually traveling sometimes very, very long distance to an office just because you can sit next to your colleague for 5 days a week? Most people will probably say, no, I would like to go in probably 2 or 3 days a week maximum to have all my meetings and see my colleagues, you know, etc. But that is actually a huge shift. And go back to your questions about what is the future of town centre. It is actually going through an extremely challenging future. Is what the hell are they going to do? You are absolutely right. I mean, I see two things. I mean, one is some of the town centre, as you described, let's say Woking, is because of COVID, so they can't actually make the business case work, so they actually start to shut down. But I also see some of the town centre is actually really thriving, because what it used to be is some of the services that you can only get in town centre, all of a sudden, is because everybody's actually working from home, they actually open out into all these kind of like suburban areas or, you know, not in the city centre. So some town centre, it is actually kind of thriving. Anecdote evidence maybe is much more affluent area, I suppose. I mean, I don't know. We don't have the data yet. So I actually see is a combination of both. You are right. You know, that town centre used to have a function, you know, because of the church or because of the services. But now because of internet shopping, you don't really actually need, you know, you, with a click of a button, you know, things will actually arrive possibly within the same day. But some of the things you don't really actually want to buy online, aren't you? I mean, things like clothes or shoes and other things. You really actually want to go and touch it, feel it, and really have some sort of connection to it. And at the same time, we are social animals. We like to actually have a purpose to go and experience something. And going to somewhere as an experience is always actually almost ingrained to us. And I think it's up to us, but then also up to possibly policymakers and politicians actually realize that there's a role for town centre. It is changing, And it's up to us to almost kind of reinvent the high street, because we do actually like to go to these places to have an experience. And it's about complementing kind of each other.
Do you think it'd be built more around leisure than it would around services where it was before? Because it strikes me that I'm quite happy to shop online. I'm the typical male shopper, you know. I want something, I'll browse the internet, I'll look and I'll see, yep, that's at a decent price, that's what I want. It'll arrive at my front door tomorrow. I don't need to go to 15 shops to find that. That's cool. I like doing it that way. And you're right, if you're buying a suit and you're buying an expensive suit, you want to go and try that on, really. You don't really want that coming through the post. But I think the town centre here, and I'm using mine as an example, there's a growing population around this town, fast growing. And there's an awful lot of people there that are probably going to be working, as you say, a hybrid way, which COVID has forced. I mean, quick question before I get there. Do you think COVID has forced what was going to happen anyway? Do you think this was inevitable, but it would have taken 20 years maybe?
The short answer, yes. I mean, even down to, I remember a piece of research that I actually read when I was working for DEGW. And it's actually written by a great architect called Frank Duffy. He almost kind of single-handedly actually doing all the research about how offices actually work. And then looking at, as we call it back in the 80s, is open plan office in a very efficient way. And he's the one who's almost kind of back in the 80s and 90s actually saying, you cannot actually keep on having open plan office for everyone, because it looks like a very efficient way to do it, but human interaction doesn't actually work like that. And subsequently, he's almost way ahead of his time, and subsequently actually see open plan office being readapted into different ways. So you can actually see, you know, some of these slightly more lifestyle offices that you can see, let's say, in Google or Apple, you know, whatever. I mean, that is actually almost kind of go back to some of the research actually done by Frank Duffy. He actually predicted, you know, quite a long time ago when laptop actually started to come out, and with the internet, you know, as well. So, well, in the distant future, if you actually have a network, as long as you can just log on to your network with a laptop, you can work anywhere. You don't need an office to actually get work done. He actually predicted that, you know, quite a long time ago. And it's only actually taken a pandemic that we really actually say, well, you know what? Well, not every profession can actually work that way. For the vast majority of people, I mean, even before the pandemic, I certainly actually see quite a lot of people with their laptop and their mobile phone, and they just work in cafes. You know, cafes became their meeting place and becomes their places to meet and work and, you know, where they meet clients and conduct businesses, you know, which is actually not uncommon. And now it just much more accelerate, you know, to that. But I actually go back to, you know, what you're saying, you know, in terms of Tang Center. You know, yes, you're right. Probably it's much more like an experience in the Tang Center. It is indeed. But I'm always curious to say, well, I think it's about, is it need a bit of both? Yes, you know, you can actually place all your online shoppings, you know, or whatever, and do it online because you don't want to go to the shop and run through all the aisles, you know, or whatever. But what is actually stopping you, just say for instance, right, is you order all your online shopping and then you can pick it up in one of your local corner shop, delivered to there. But right next door, you'll have your favorite bread shop or your favorite butcher who will give you the dry-aged steak or the sourdough bread that you would quite like to pick up. And then at the same time, you know, you will have your cup of coffee with your mate to have a chat. What is actually stopping you to doing that?
It becomes less mainstream and more niche. So you're looking at things that you can't get on the internet, things that you can't easily buy online that you can experience and not just buy. And that's the shift. There's a government shift that's got to happen as well here, isn't there? Because, I mean, the government at the moment is pretty keen to get everybody back into London as soon as possible because there's an infrastructure there that the economy is depending on. However, as you quite rightly say, I think, people aren't keen to jump on that train and do that journey 5 days a week now. They might do it two or three. And I absolutely accept that if you're in a creative job, there is nothing like being in the room with people. That creativity flows in a way that it doesn't online. Mm. And so those people need to be there. But for many jobs, it'll be 2 days at home, 3 days in the office, or the other way round. The centre of London is going to have to change quite a lot, isn't it, over the course of the next 5 to 10 years?
It is indeed. And the big question is, what is the role of these big city centre? What are they going to do? What's it going to be? And I suppose even during COVID, quite a lot of people just say, oh, that's the death of cities now, you know, that will get decentralized and cities, you know, the glory days of cities as we know it is actually over. And I'm not so sure that is the case. You know, cities in a generic term, cities, they always invent themselves and they will do whatever is necessary via economics or via policies or whatever, right? They will always adapt and change in order to survive, whether we like it or not. We may not like the look of it, but they will change because of this kind of survival instincts that cities, you know, policymakers and landowners, et cetera, you know, they will do whatever is necessary to make it attractive, you know, again. And it's just a reinvention. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, what will happen afterwards.
I'm going to be watching it really closely because I love London. There's nothing like going in and walking around London, as you say, and looking at the architecture and looking, but it's going to change and that's going to be interesting to see how it does. And there's an awful lot of landlords making an awful lot of money, have done for many years there, that have now got to rethink the way that they operate, which is going to be interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, just to look at, let's say, isn't that John Lewis? You just say they're going to convert quite a lot of their existing portfolio into residential. I mean, that's going to be quite interesting. I mean, just for an example, right? I mean, almost kind of like tongue-in-cheek, right? You know, just say John Lewis in Oxford Street, if they can somehow convert half of it into residential, wouldn't you actually want to live there? You know, I mean, not for everybody, maybe not for me, you know, at this stage, but in some way I would say I wouldn't mind to actually live right in the middle of Oxford Street.
An incredible building as well. I mean, an incredible area.
An incredible area to live in and loads of shoppings and experience, you know, around right in the middle of the city. You know, it will be quite amazing, you know, for certain types of people. It will be amazing.
The world is changing fast and education needs to keep up. The Edge Foundation is working to help to prepare students to thrive in a fast-changing society.
I'm going to move us on. You've maintained, as you mentioned right at the start, a sort of link back to research and teaching, which is, I get the feeling, a very precious part of your life at the moment. Something that you really like doing is that teaching, that lecturing. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, how does it feed your professional existence as well? Because the two are very different, but I would imagine one feeds the other.
Well, it is. I suppose it comes with your upbringing, you know, whatever, you're just giving back, you know, what you're being given. I was quite privileged to have an education here and then went to UCL, you could say probably one of the best university in the UK and very well known. And I just have always have close ties, you know, with that. I mean, I had 4 amazing years actually studying there. Probably the best 4 years of my life, you know, just being around that campus. It was just amazing. And when being asked to say, oh, would you like to do a bit of teaching there? And I just jump on the chances and just say, oh, yes, of course I will. And I mean, at the beginning, you think, well, you're just actually giving back, you know, what you learn. But at the same time, I find it very engaging and also kind of engage the other part of my brain, you know, as well, is actually through the act of teaching with students. Well, one, you've got to know what you're talking about. And 2, you've got to be actually quite on top of your game, you know, as well, because you may not like it, but they come and actually ask all sorts of different questions that you probably would never actually consider, you know, yourself. And that sort of keeps me on my guard, you know, as well. Well, you've got to know what you're talking about. And I mean, that's a funny story that a student that I tutor, she was actually not from a design background, but she's actually doing this kind of postgraduate course, which I taught, and I'm her dissertation tutor. And we just actually gone through kind of like a big workshop. We talk about, you know, all sorts of questions, you know, etc. It's like, oh, you should have a look at this, you know, blah, blah, blah. What you mean, you know, you need to think about, you know, this, that, and then the other. And she just sent me an email 2 days later. It's like, oh, Ming, just want to talk to you about what happens to the workshop. You know, when you say X, what exactly do you mean? You know, when you say that, do you mean by this? And it's literally quite a very short, half a page, whatever email. And I remember it took me a day to reply to her email because it really kind of questions to say some of the things that I took for granted of course, I mean, whatever. But when a student actually asks you that, you have to think, well, what exactly do I really mean by that? Because she clearly doesn't actually understand it. And you need to explain to her what it means by that.
There's a shorthand to what we all do, isn't there? That you assume knowledge and then you stand in front of a group of students, and this happens at secondary school the same as it would happen at a university, and you assume that they're going to just pick up on that. And then when they don't, you've got to dig real deep within yourself to find another way to present the same topic. And as you say, you end up questioning yourself all the time and thinking, well, actually, why did I assume that? Because it's not right to do so. So they say you never really know anything until you have to teach it to somebody else. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. And I find that process really enjoyable and really engaging. And then quite often it stretches through this discussion. New ideas will start to come up when you say, oh, what do you mean by that? You know, do you mean by this? Or can we actually look at it another way? And at the beginning, say, of course, we're not going to look at it the other way because I always actually knew this way. But then if you really think about it, say, well, why not? You know, why do you think you're right all the time? Maybe you're actually wrong. I find that extremely engaging and kind of being challenged and constantly challenging myself at the same time, you know, as well. I think that is actually really, really engaging to something that's really lovely to do.
Yeah. I'm just thinking now, you plan your teaching so carefully sometimes. And they're the ones that you'll go in the first 10 minutes, somebody will drop a grenade right in the middle of it where they ask a question that just blows it all apart. And I remember as a younger teacher, I used to try and stick with the lesson plan and go with it. But the more experience I got, it was like, okay, that's a brilliant question. Forget what I've written. We're just going to talk about that now for 40 minutes. We're just going to concentrate on that.
Yeah.
And you've got to go with the flow sometimes, haven't you?
Yeah. And that is one of the most enjoyable thing about teaching, you know, as well.
You never know what's going to happen. You never know.
Yeah.
Last question, really, before we move to the quick fire round. You've recently become a design council expert. I'm intrigued. I mean, we do quite a bit of work with the design council. It's an organization that I've got a whole load of respect for. What exactly is a design council expert, and what are you required to do for that role?
That's only a very recent appointment. Well, what they are looking for, I mean, is only at the beginning. And then they are actually going through, well, because of COVID and because of the administrative change, you know, as well, we haven't fully engaged, you know, into the program yet. But what essentially, why they actually want these design council experts is mainly is for the built environment they're very interested in. And they want to have a pool of experts on different subjects. So ranging from architecture, town planning, urban design, down to even just design or to sociologists or anthropologists, you know, all that. So they just want to have a pool of professional ready to help them. From what I know is they have a certain program which they actually want to engage in. So one of them could be research. And then another big part, you know, of the design council is they also carry out what we call a design review panel. So it could be a major planning application for an area, and they will need a panel expert to almost go in and give informed advice to the design team, looking at the scheme and understanding what they are dealing with, and almost going to say, well, okay, you have actually done some very interesting design unit here, but have you thought about this or have you thought about that? All these sort of things. So that's one of the main functions, you know, on the design council experts. But as I said, they're currently in the middle of actually trying to roll out the program. So I'll need to wait and see, you know, to see what will come out of that.
Really sounds interesting. We're going to move to the quick fire round. Fire five questions at you and just really shoot from the hip here with what comes back. So the first one, what piece of advice with hindsight would you give your younger self aged 11 to 15?
Just believe in yourself.
Yeah, it's amazing how many times people say that is that if I could go back, it was just go with it. Just go with the flow, believe it. Is there a teacher, a subject or a moment where there was that trigger that you just thought, ah, now I get it. Now I get it.
Probably it's actually slightly later on. I think it's actually at the beginning of my retraining to be an architect. And I went to Barcelona, lovely place. And being an architecture student, you know, at the time, obviously, you know, I have to go to all these kind of different buildings, you know, to have a look. But it just, whatever happened, you know, I just managed to carve out an afternoon that I can actually go and visit all this building by myself without my family. You know, that is a quite a rare thing. And I remember actually visiting a pavilion called a German pavilion designed by a very famous modernist architect called Mies van der Rohe in Barcelona. And, you know, going in there and actually walk through, it's a very simple pavilion, very, very simple, very modernist, minimalist, you know, or whatever. But it's the first time that when I actually go in there, I actually understand the concept of a space and room, how you divide up space and room, you know, together through what you call architecture. And that is almost kind of like a light bulb moment. So, oh, that's what he mean by that. And yeah, that's quite inspiring.
Sounds great. I can almost picture you there standing in the middle of it all. Who or what inspires you now? Where does your inspiration come from now for what you do?
Well, it's actually two things. I'm actually a hobbyist photographer. So I constantly have my camera, you know, with me. Always like to actually go and photograph cities. And well, at the moment is mostly actually London, but it always amazes me when you go around with a camera to try to capture urban life. And it always actually inspires me to say, it is amazing, you know, that what we created as places, that is actually pure human creation of places with buildings and spaces and streets and squares. And then people come and actually go and do things, you know, around these places. And you can actually capture that moment. That really inspires me. And also, as I probably touched earlier, you know, is the teaching, you know, with students, that's always inspires me, because you're just constantly being challenged and just say, well, what do you think of that? And then suddenly they go, oh yeah, I haven't actually thought about that. I really should look it up myself.
London's looked very different the last 12, 18 months, hasn't it? I've been in a few times and I've never seen it so empty, but you actually notice the buildings and the space a lot more when it's not crowded with people.
Yeah.
It's been an incredible place.
Absolutely incredible place.
This one's always a little bit contentious. I mean, is there a professional error that you look back on and you think, I learned a lot from that? Or is there a highlight of something that you did where it was like, that was a wow moment? That was, and it could be either, or it could be both.
Ooh, what would it be? I suppose, yeah, it's a professional error. I learned that probably later on, is I thought I couldn't actually do it myself. And I don't actually believe in myself enough. And I always think I need someone else to help me, so to speak. Or if I don't have that person or have someone else to lift me up, I wouldn't be able to do it myself. I was wrong. And it turns out that person, quite a lot of the time, is, I go back to, you know, to the things about believing yourself, is you actually find out, well, quite often you actually find out that person or persons or whatever probably actually know less than you do. And you think this person will give you all the answer. But in fact, you have all the answers in the world, you know, already. You just need to believe in it.
That is such an important message for young people. We have lots of A-level students listening to this podcast here now. And that's a really important message, because it doesn't matter whether you're 18, 17 or 58, as I am. We all get that imposter syndrome, you know, that little thing on your shoulder that says you can't. Who are you trying to fool? That's not going to happen. And you're right. 9 times out of 10, you can.
Yeah. But also the thing is, why not? You know, what have you got to lose? I think my mantra now is, why don't you give it a go? Even if you fail, at least you know to say, right, I fail because I lack something. Rather than just having this thing, just thinking that, I can't do it if I don't have someone else, you know, with me, you know, or whatever, you know, just give it a try. You only have one life. Just give it a try. If you fail, at least you know, rather than not doing it in the first place.
Fear of failure stops us from doing so much. And I remember I worked with one head teacher who was very, very good with one-liners. And he said, look, let's just give it a go. Tomorrow, the sun will still come up. We'll be fine. And absolutely. That's the way to look on many things, I think.
Absolutely.
What advice would you give if there's somebody out there now that's thinking, oh, architecture or urban planning is something that might not have jumped out to many people listening to it, but they might be listening to it now and thinking, well, actually, yeah, that really interests me. What advice would you give somebody that's thinking, well, that might be for me?
Well, I think one of the things that if you want to study architecture or actually being an urbanist is, you've got to be quite a curious person. And that curiosity is, I know it's a very, very cliche word, but what I mean that is, it doesn't mean that you have to be this thing that you're going to be the next discovery, you know, or whatever, right? You just got to be curious about and asking why, even the most mundane questions that you think nobody else in the world will actually be interested. But actually, you may actually turn out that is actually quite interesting. Just give an example of place profile that I actually set up. It's just the three of us actually having this conversation, you know, together. So why did nobody actually measure the cities? when everyone just saying, well, of course you don't measure the cities. You know, what are you talking about? Why do you want to measure it? You know, we never actually do it that way. And it's just some very, very small things. It could be a very small kind of idea. Just go with it and see what happens. And it's an iterative thing. And if it doesn't happen, you know, now, maybe it will come back later. And just be curious and just ask questions.
That's my word of the moment, is curious. You know, somebody asked me a short while ago, what are you hoping to achieve with design and technology? And I said, the curiosity that is natural when we're tiny. You know, we're all born curious, aren't we?
Ooh.
A 2-3-year-old, their biggest question is why? You know, why is this? Why is that? Why does that colour? Why is that shape? Why do we go there? Why do we do this? But it gets knocked out of us by education if we're not careful. And I don't want that to be knocked out. I want that to stay in students as long as possible. And I want it to grow, actually. I want us to ask bigger questions as we get older. So, yeah, that word curious is my word of the moment, actually. I love it. So, yeah, thank you for that. Ming, thank you so much. We've covered an hour, but it's whizzed by, and I've really, really enjoyed the conversation. And thank you so much for giving up your time. I know you're incredibly busy with everything that's going on, but really, really do appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me. And I hope it actually inspires many, many students to be curious. And maybe we actually have one or two architects or urbanists, you know, in the process, you know, who knows?
I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I definitely did. I just find it so interesting that we're transitioning from one phase of life to another. The way that we shop, the way that we use our local town centres, city centres, is changing. I personally feel from that conversation and from other conversations that I've had that it's landlords that are holding on at the moment because their way of life, their income stream has been severely dented over the course of COVID, and they're waiting for life to return to normal, and I'm not sure it's gonna. I think over time, landlords, the same as everybody else, will have to readjust. And also, business rates, I think, will have to change. Not an area that I'm an expert in, but we can't have empty town centres. They've got to become where people go to socialise, where people go to relax, where people still go to shop, but perhaps shop in a different way than we shopped prior to COVID. I mean, if we're really honest, the town centres were dying anyway. All that COVID's done is accelerated it and has brought it closer too. So huge thanks to Ming for being such an interesting guest and giving us his insight into those areas. And I really, really hope you enjoyed that conversation. Just a few thanks before we finish. I'd like to thank the Edge Foundation for being our founding partners and enabling this podcast to be here in the first place. This is our, I think, 26th podcast recorded, which is incredible, really, when I think back to last August when we had this idea to create a podcast. And here we are, 26, 27 episodes in. So thanks to The Edge for being with us every step of that way. And also to PTC Onshape. PTC having quite an impact in schools across the UK at the moment. More and more schools picking up CAD and introducing that as part of their curriculum offer. And I know from being in school myself that one of the main things that you want is you want students to be able to intuitively pick up a piece of CAD software to use it. And quite often that will mean that you're using fairly low spec machines, both in school and definitely at home, where you can't guarantee that a student's going to have a high spec machine. But because everything's cloud based with PTC, students can go home and can continue to work on a machine that perhaps is not fully spec'd at home, and can still make progress, can still work, and can still produce stuff and to an industry standard, which is so, so important. So huge welcome to PTC Onshape as sponsors, and thanks to them for helping us to push the bandwidth of this podcast just a little bit more. We've got great download figures, but I want them to be bigger. I want the impact to be bigger. I want to reach more schools. I want to reach more students, and I want to reach more business and industry. So if you know anybody that hasn't listened to an episode of this yet, please point them in this direction. Just point them towards Spotify, Google, Apple, wherever they get their podcasts, and just ask them to have one listen to perhaps an episode that you particularly enjoyed, and just see if we can gather them as guests. Also, if you like what you hear today, then if you could go back to wherever you downloaded this podcast from and just give us a review, that would make all the difference in the world. It helps us to see that what we're doing is right, but it also helps us to improve podcasts in the future. So one last thank you is to you for taking the time out, for putting this podcast in your ear, and for taking the time to listen. And that's something I will never take for granted. So have a great day, and thanks so much for tuning in. Until the next time, stay safe.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you did, hit the subscribe button now, as we have guests lined up for future pods that will inform, inspire, and entertain. This podcast is brought to you by the Design and Technology Association.